Anyway, as you know, we're still at the very beginning of the story that we're supposed to be studying. And let's turn right to chapter 37, verse 1, because it will take us a while today to get by verse 1. It's true. That's the way the Jewish tradition works. So I'm going to take you through a sort of exegesis means interpretation. It's the word, I don't know why people use that word, but in rabbinical school, everybody always talks about exegesis. So I'm going to take you through the exegetical history of this verse a little bit to make what I think is a beautiful point about life that all of us will understand, but you would never get there just by reading this verse unless you know how it goes. So, Vayeshev Yaakov. And Yaakov literally sat, okay, but really means stayed. Beretz Megurei Aviv, in the place where his ancestors had traveled, Eretz Canaan, okay, the land of Canaan. Now, Vayeshev implies to the commentators sitting or settling in the sense of finally, after a very tumultuous early life, Yaakov was going to get some peace. Okay? Now, as we know, he doesn't get peace. Right? In fact, what's going to happen is he's about to lose the child that he loves best, and then he's going to have to go to Egypt, and he's going to spend all these years mourning, and all sorts of things are going to happen to him. But what Rashi says here, Rashi being the most important rabbinic, the most important Jewish commentator on the Torah, and one of the reasons why he's the most important is that he brings the Rashi did two things. He commented on the Talmud, and you'd never study the Talmud without Rashi, ever, ever, ever. Nobody does. There's no Talmud that's printed without Rashi. And he also wrote a commentary to the Torah. And what he does in the Torah is he brings most of the time the rabbinic comments from the Talmud and applies them to the Torah. So he says here, what does that mean? Tzadikim, righteous people, mivakshim, ask, like bikesh, to leshev bishalva, to sit or settle in shalva, which means sort of in, I don't want to use the word peace because I'm going to use that for something else, but in calm. They want a calm life. That's what tzadikim really want, right? Righteous people really want a calm life, but God doesn't give it to them. And Rashi says, why doesn't God give it to them? Because God says you don't get to enjoy what in rabbinic literature is called shtei shulchanot, which means two tables. Two tables are the table of this world and the table of the next world. So if, in fact, God allowed righteous people to get their reward in this world by living a calm life, then they wouldn't be able to get their full reward in the next world because they would have already used up their reward. So what happens to righteous people is they live tumultuous, difficult lives in this world.
What a relief.
Which, by the way, for all of us who've led calm lives in this world, does not bode well for what's going to happen. But, well, you understand why this theory developed, because the rabbis were trying to explain why, I mean, remember in rabbinic times, righteous people didn't live such good lives. So we're not going to discuss the theory itself right now, which could be a whole separate class, but that's a very common rabbinic theory, okay? There's a certain amount of reward and punishment that is allotted based on your life, and if you suffer in this world, one of the ways that the rabbis calmed you was to say that you're going to get it in the next life, what you did not get in this life, okay? So this is Rashi's comment on the verse, all right? So we still have a ways to go before we get to where we want to get to, but let's just trace the idea. It says, Vayeshev Yaakov. Now, why does it say Vayeshev in particular? There are lots of words the Torah could have used for settling, because it's saying Yaakov was seeking calm after his tumultuous life. We know that he doesn't get calm, so Rashi has to explain that, and he explains it by saying, God doesn't give you that calm. So then another commentator comes along and says, hold on. That doesn't appear to be, in fact, the way that the Torah talks about him, because earlier in chapter 33, I didn't mark the verse. Here it is in chapter 33, verse 18. It says, "Vayavo," which means "and came Yaakov Shalem," like Shalom, "Ir Shechem." Yaakov came Shalem to Ir Shechem. So obviously, Yaakov gets Shalom. What does it mean that he gets Shalom, but he doesn't get Shalva? Because Rashi already said what he does not get in this life is Shalva, which means calm. But Shalom is sort of the same thing, isn't it? Right? Peace or calm. They just sound like two words for the same thing. So now, a later commentator has to explain what Rashi must have meant by saying Yaakov did not get Shalva, because we know from the Torah that Yaakov did get Shalem. So what's the difference between Shalva and Shalem? All right, you with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. This is how, when you study Torah, this is how it invariably goes. You have to comment on the comment on the comment. So, Iturei Torah, which is a collection of Hasidic commentaries, that means 500 years after Rashi, who lived 1,000 years after the Talmud, which flourished 1,000 years after the Torah, okay, says as follows. Vayavo Yaakov Shalem. Yaakov came Shalem. Now, what's the rabbinic comment on Shalem? How do the rabbis explain what Shalem is? Shalem begufo. He was physically Shalem. In other words, he was healthy. Shalem b'mamono. His possessions were intact. He still had his money. He did, because remember, traveling, according to the rabbis, can diminish your money, right? Especially in ancient times. You had to pay for hotels. Shalem b'toroto. Betorato, he was also full in his learning. So from traveling, how was he Shalem? He didn't lose his money, he didn't lose his health, he didn't lose his learning, okay? So then what is Shalva, if it's not that? Bechina Shalva hi hatzimtzum. Shalva, calm, means that you want to diminish your life. You want to make it smaller. That's what people who are looking for Shalva are looking for. They say, I don't want all these complications. I want to turn off my email account. I want to turn off the television. I want to live in a small place, you know, somewhere in Northern California with a garden and a cottage. That's Shalva, okay? It's not the same thing as Shalem. It's not the same thing as peace or wholeness. In fact, it's Tzimtzum, and that idea of Tzimtzum, remember, comes from the Kabbalah. Those of you who studied the Kabbalah might recognize this idea. In the Kabbalah, the idea of tzimtzum, which means contraction, is that God, in order to create the world, had to contract into God's self to make a space of not God for the world to be created. Okay? Because if the whole world is full of God, there's no place for us. So in order, this is according to Luria. According to Luria, who was a great Kabbalist of the 16th century in Tzfat, he said, in order to make the world, God had to withdraw, and God withdrew and created this space in the world for human beings to be created. Okay, that's why there are spaces of not God in the world. It's because of God's own voluntary contraction so that there'd be room for us. So what they're saying is, when Yaakov came finally, after the business with Esav, and after the business with Rachel and Leah, and after all the difficulties, when he came, he said, you know what, now I'm going to make my life simple. No more struggling, no more fighting, no more battles, just simple. And God said, no. Tzadikim don't get to do that, right? Because in fact, you have a mission in this world and you aren't allowed, you can have shlemut, you can have wholeness, but you can't withdraw from the world, because remember that Judaism doesn't have monasteries, right? We actually don't approve of withdrawal from the world, and you can only do it for a very short time. Right? There is, in fact, a story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who you might recognize as the presumed author of the Zohar, although probably wasn't the author of the Zohar, but that's another story. Anyway, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was a Talmudic rabbi, hid in a cave from the Romans. When he came out of the cave, he saw people, this story is told in the Talmud, he saw Jews who were plowing their field, like making a living, basically living the normal way. And he said, is this what I, you know, conducted a rebellion and hid for so that you could just live these pedestrian lives. And because he was Shimon Bar Yochai, according to the Talmud, a fire came from his eyes and tore and burned up the field. At which point, a voice came out of heaven. A voice coming out of heaven is from God. And God said, if you've come to destroy my world, go back to your cave. Okay? Withdrawal from the world and contempt of the world is not actually something that the rabbis like. So when Yaakov says, I just want to live a quiet life, God says no. And right after that, you'll notice what's the very next thing. Eilet toldot Yaakov Yosef. These are the generations of Yaakov, Joseph. Right? And Joseph already, we know, is going to prevent Yaakov from living that kind of quiet life. Okay, so that's the first point I wanted to make, which is the difference between shalom and shalva, between peace and contraction, and the idea that that in fact Yaakov doesn't get that wish. The second point of just two or three that I want to make in the first two verses today is that when you say these are the generations, Eilet Toldot, that's always followed by a genealogy. These are the generations of Jacob. Jacob begat this one and begat that one and begat the other one, right? But here it isn't that. It says these are the generations of Jacob, Joseph. In a way telling you that what Joseph is going to be and is going to carry on, that's Jacob's real legacy, right? Doesn't mention all the other children he had. Now, we know about the other children he had from the previous chapter, and we'll know about them from the next chapter, but it's very unusual to say these are the generations of Jacob, Joseph. And we're told that Joseph was 17 years old, and it says, this is the line of Jacob. Now, in my English translation, it a little bit distorts the way it's written in the Hebrew. It says, at 17 years of age, Joseph tended the flocks with his brothers as a helper to the sons of his father's wife, Bilhah and Zilpah. Now, let me explain that translation, too, because it doesn't translate the way you might think it would. First of all, he's 17, and it says, V'hu na'ar. He was a youth. Right? Na'ar is a youth. It's what Aharon is called. He's called a Na'ar, maybe Aharon or Moses, depending on how you read the verse. But here the rabbis start talking about youth and what youth means. And there are several different interpretations. One is that Joseph was vain. Okay? There was a nice, actually, quotation that I just read from Midnight Oil, which is, I think, a short story by V.S. Pritchett, where he says that one of the things that you have in youth that you lose as you get older is a dramatic interest in yourself. Not an interest in yourself, because everyone has an interest, but a dramatic interest in yourself. It's like observing your own reactions is fascinating when you're young. You won't believe how I felt when that happened. And all of us have that when we're young. That's what it means to be young. It's part of self-discovery. But you lose that as you get older. Well, the rabbis felt that, especially since, remember, the theme of vanity plays through Joseph's life because of Potiphar's wife later, who tries to seduce him. So the rabbis think that what the mention, particularly after giving his name of saying that he was a Na'ar, was because Joseph was always primping and preening, and it also fits with his vanity and the coat of many colors and all of that. I do a shtick and then I take questions. So that idea of being vain, because otherwise I never get through the stuff. That idea of being vain, I don't anyway, but follows as a thread through Joseph's story, and in part it's important because it's one of the things that Joseph has to overcome in order to become Joseph. Right? We're interested in an arc of growth here in the Joseph story. So there's that, but that's not the only possible meaning of Na'ar. It's also used when I'll read you the verse. It's in Exodus. You don't have to turn to it. Chapter 33, verse 11, because you probably didn't mark it off as I did before you came here. You read the following. You read, and the Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one man would speak to another, and then he would return to the camp. Right? Yehoshua bin Nun Na'ar. Joshua, son of Nun, a youth, would not stir out of the tent. Now, it's interesting that here they translate it as a youth, because here they say that the reason they translate this as helper is because of that verse. Why was Joshua ben Nun called a Na'ar? Because he was Joseph's assistant in the way that, I mean, he was Moses' assistant in the way that Joseph was assistant to his older brothers. That's why they translate Na'ar as helper, but the rabbis see Na'ar as youth. The other reason that it's important that they translate it as youth is not only his vanity, but because of what follows, right? It says, as a helper to the sons of his father's wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. Now, anybody notice anything strange about that, Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives?
Yeah.
Two things are strange. First, they're called wives, right? Second, they're out of chronological order. He married Zilpah before he married Bilhah, or had children with Zilpah before he had children with Bilhah. But Bilhah was Rachel's mate. So Joseph is going to feel closer to Bilhah than he's going to feel to Zilpah, right? So first of all, his father's wives, Bilhah and Zilpah, and Joseph brought bad reports of them to their father. Now, there's a lot of discussion of this. First of all, what kind of reports did he bring? And it says there are attempts to exonerate Joseph and there are attempts to blame him in the tradition. And both of them in some way have their point, because it doesn't say what kind of reports he brought. And presumably if they were doing something wrong, it would say he brought reports of their doing this wrong or doing that wrong. So some of the rabbis try to get him out of it. Some of them say that he, because he was young, he brought reports in the way that he felt as though his duty was to tell his father everything, right? Because that's what little kids do. They tell their parents everything, and Joseph was very attached to his father. We find out in the next verse that his father loved him best. So it wasn't really that he was bad, it was just that he had loyalty to his father. The ones who really try to get him off, and there, as you can imagine, among the rabbis, there are some who don't like the idea that the heroes of the Bible do anything wrong. They say what it means when it says Joseph brought bad reports was his conduct, by contrast, was so much better than the people around him that it was as if it was a reproach to them how nicely Joseph acted, right? Because and this isn't that far-fetched, because every parent knows, and that for that matter, every child, that idea of saying, why can't you be more like your brother, right? Your brother's sitting and behaving so nicely, and the brother then, who's sitting and behaving nicely, consciously or not, and sometimes, let's face it, it's deliberate, consciously or not, is casting a reproach on the one who's behaving badly, right? And you know sometimes that that's how you draw fire to the other one, is by behaving well. Because the default mode of kids is, you know, in certain situations not to behave well. So that's, they could see. And also there is something in Joseph of the being too good, Nick. You know, that's like, that's what he, that's the feeling that he gives. And then it says, and then the third possibility, notice also, by the way, that it says, that he told on the kids of Bilhah and Zilpah, but he doesn't tell on the kids of Rachel and Leah. So there, again, are two ways of seeing this. One is that that's just, he was just with them, but he really gave, well, three ways, that he really gave a report of all the brothers. That's possible, because it turns out later that all the brothers hate him. And second is, why is he with the brothers of Bilhah and Zilpah? Either because they were younger, and he was younger, or because his status was lower in the house. So he didn't get to be with the sons of Rachel and Leah, whose status is going to be higher since they were the real, quote, wives, right? So Joseph gets stuck with Bilhah and Zilpah because the real kids don't want to be with him. And therefore, when he goes and tells on people, he's going to tell on Bilhah and Zilpah, which may be why, according to some commentators, later on, when he gets thrown into the pit, the kids of Bilhah and Zilpah don't pull him out. I mean, why don't they pull him out? They're the ones who are his sort of natural constituency, right? But they don't pull him out because he went and told on them before, so they figure, let him die. And then the third possibility here is that he tells on the kids of Bilhah and Zilpah specifically because he wants to be part of the children of Rachel and Leah. And if there's a division between the two groups of kids, maybe this is Joseph's lame attempt to get Rachel and Leah to like him by telling on the kids of Bilhah and Zilpah. And all of these possibilities exist just as all these possibilities exist in families with multiple children, right? There are always groupings. In fact, my mother, I have three brothers. My mother told me when she gave birth to my younger brother, Danny, who was born 6 years after I was born, right? There was a cluster of my older brother 2 years, my second brother a year and a half, me, and then 6 years, Danny. And when he was born, a woman in Harrisburg, where he was born, an older woman came up to my mother and said, "Oh, thank God you had another child." And she said, "You know, thank you very much, but why thank God?" And the woman said, "Because three cannot walk on the sidewalk together." Very interesting, right? And I never forgot, my mother told me that years later, I never forgot it. The idea is that you have to have a natural pairing because three can't walk on the sidewalk together, right? And bizarrely enough, by the way, I never made this connection until I just said that, but bizarrely enough, when I was diagnosed with lymphoma and I had to go to City of Hope to get, you get bone marrow typing in case you ever need a bone marrow transplant, right? A stem cell transplant, so you have to go. And all my brothers had to give their blood to see if any of them are typed, because obviously if it's someone in your family, you have a better, and I was matched with my brother Paul, the one who's coming here for Scholar in Residence, and my younger brother Danny happened to be perfectly matched with my brother Steve. So that woman in Harrisburg knew what she was talking about. And it's been scientifically proven. Very, very interesting, very bizarre. But so anyway, the way that we got to all this is that Joseph's natural alliance is with the, because it's not, I said with the children of Rachel and Leah, but it's really with the children of Leah, right? Because Joseph has one very young brother named Benjamin, and he's alone. Benjamin's a kid, and it's all these children of Leah, and if he wants to feel, and you can understand why they would resent Joseph to start off with. Before the dreams, before the coat of many colors, even before it says that his father loved him best, he's the only grown child of the mother that all the kids knew their father preferred to their own mother. So that's not a recipe for family harmony. They already know that their mother was the less favored mother. And you can imagine, even though the Torah doesn't say it, you can imagine what it was like to grow up in the house and see their father treat their mother differently from the way he treated Rachel. So you have to believe that they already, I mean, even before Joseph turns out to be the one who gets the coat of many colors and all of that, you have to believe that there's a certain built-in resentment there. And then when Joseph brings bad reports back to their father, it's obviously going to be something that is going to build the resentment and shift the alliance of Bilhah and Zilpah's kids to the kids of Leah. The very complicated family dynamics are important to understand because what seems later inexplicable, which is that they would throw their brother into a pit basically to die, even though they decide in the end, let's not kill him, let's sell him into slavery. That seems, just because he had dreams or just because his father liked him best, but you can imagine if the resentment has been simmering for years and years and years. And then, as you'll see later, when do they do this? When their father sends him to find them. They're out pasturing the flock. And they know when Joseph comes out and you're working, what's he coming out for? To spy on you. Because that's what he did with Bilhah and Zilpah's kids. So when you have all that background, which the Torah gives you in very, very abbreviated terms, then the idea that they hate Joseph enough to want to kill him doesn't seem as strange as it would if you just read this quickly and you didn't spend the time to actually think about what life was like. And the reason that I bring this up also is that we have to remember that the people who originally read these stories lived the same life as the people in the stories. So they knew what it was to go out and pasture flock and to be alone and to have the father who's going to divide up the property hear bad things about you, right? And they lived still in a tribal life. We're so far away from it that we read their motives as though they lived in Brentwood. And we have to remember how different, that the human motives are the same, but the circumstances are very different, and these resentments can be simmering for years and years and years before they see Joseph come about to tell bad things about them in their own view. And that is what the catalyst that then gets them to take this action. Now just let me mention one or two quick things, and then we'll take questions and comments. The other point about this, of course, is that the actor in this whose motives we're going to have to unpack is not Joseph, because actually his motives will come with the dreams, but Jacob. And in some ways, the Joseph story is really a part of the larger Jacob story, because it's Jacob who gives birth to all these children, who favors one over the other, who grows them, and at the end, who blesses them. And it's Jacob, after all, who makes a nation. And the irony of it is, of course, that, and we'll talk about this more next time when we talk about Jacob's favoring Joseph, but Jacob comes from a house where the favoring of one child over another tore the family apart, right? Isaac loves Esau. Jacob loves, Rebecca loves Joseph, Jacob. And by the way, the idea that Jacob is settling, where it says Vayeshev, is the opposite of Esau, because remember it says that Esau, what verse is it? That Esau traveled because there was too much for the two of them. Right. It says Esau took wives and sons and daughters. I'm just reading from chapter 36. And all his cattle and his livestock, and went to another land because of his brother Joseph, for their possessions were too many for them to dwell together. Right? So Jacob gets to stay, Esau has to leave. Even Jacob's ability to stay is based on that original favoritism which tore the family apart, Isaac for Esau and Rebekah for Jacob. But then, as so often happens to us, you know, it's Freud's repetition compulsion, that you repeat the same thing with the hope that you'll get a different result, which obviously rarely happens. And so what was done to you, you do to abusers. Those who are abused become abusers. Jacob, who is favored, becomes a favorer. And he gets, in some ways, the same result, in some ways better and in some ways worse, as happened to him, which is it tears his family apart, that he favors one over the other. The only final thing I'll say is that the condemnation, you have to decide, is the condemnation of his action or of his emotion. That is, do you blame a parent for loving one child more than another when that's involuntary? I mean, can you help it if you love one child more than another? But the extent to which you demonstrate that or express it, that is voluntary. So most of the rabbis don't so much condemn Jacob for his feelings as for the coat, which was an indicator, right? Especially given that Joseph was already Rachel's kid. And again, it's hard to blame Jacob for loving one sister more than another, but it's very easy to blame him for the way he may have demonstrated it. Okay, so let me stop there, and there were questions. 1, 2, 3.
Yeah. Isn't an hour also used for just any unmarried man?
Yes, in especially in modern Hebrew. Nar is used for a variety of things. The thing is, let me just say one thing about Nar while we're there. What happens is when Moses is put in the basket, okay, and Pharaoh's daughter comes down to the Nile, and it says that she opened the basket, Vihine Nar Boche, and behold, a child crying. So there are many interesting things about that phrase, which is familiar to me because this is what I gave my senior sermon on, actually, in rabbinical school. One is that she sees him crying instead of hears him crying, right? Which suggests that he cried silently, because had he cried out loud, he would have been killed, because if anyone had heard him, right? But when it says vihine na'ar boche, you almost never call a baby a na'ar. So one of the commentators very cleverly says, and who was the crying Na'ar? It was Aaron. Aaron was hiding in the bushes, watching out over Moses, and when he saw that Pharaoh's daughter was open the basket, he cried first out of fear, because it's Pharaoh's daughter, who knows what she's gonna do to a Hebrew child, and then out of despair when she took him, because he knew that his brother was gonna grow up. And in fact, they have a reunion later in the Bible. So yeah, Na'ar usually means a young unmarried man, and that's why it's strange that they apply it to Moses in that context. Yeah.
Your repetition compulsion may, about somebody looking for a different result, may answer this question, but didn't Jacob know sending Joseph out to his brothers like a sheep to wolves, and especially after all these years of tension, that it was...
Right, well, we haven't gotten to the part where Jacob sends Joseph out, and we'll talk about it at the time in more detail, but it is a question about why Jacob thinks that sending Joseph to his brothers is a good idea. And there are at least, one possibility is maybe he resented Joseph for his dreams. So he thought, let them, you know, knock him around a little bit and take him down a peg. But also there's something very curious about Jacob is responsible, in quotes, for the death or near death of the people he loves most. Remember, he says, whoever took the idols from Laban's house, may they die. And who really took them?
Rachel.
He sends Joseph to his brothers, and they sell him into slavery. It's a very bizarre thing, and we'll talk about it more. I'm not sure exactly how to interpret it, but it's... And there's a beautiful midrash that we'll also come back to, but you know, it's all one story, so it doesn't matter if we go back and forth. There's a beautiful midrash where someone says to Joseph, I'm trying to remember who it was, it's after Potiphar and after all of that, someone says to Joseph, I love you very much, in the midrash. This is a rabbinic story, it's not in the Bible. Someone says to Joseph, I love you very much, and he says, don't love me, love has given me nothing but pain. His father loved him, gave him nothing but pain. Potiphar's wife loved him, gave him nothing but pain, right? So Joseph, but that's an older Joseph, right, than we have here. So, yeah.
Looking at the whole picture, wasn't it possibly predetermined? Because if they hadn't thrown him, if he hadn't sent him to his brothers, they hadn't thrown him out of the pit, if he hadn't been sold to slavery, it would not have saved the family.
Well, so
the outcome of the whole thing was really good.
Yes and no, and yes again. That is, yeah, in a larger sense, if you want to say that everything in the Bible is predetermined because you're going to get the result that God wants, yes. And this is a question we've discussed before, and no doubt will again. But in another sense, no. In the sense that you've got to assume, since we judge the characters of the Bible, and the Bible judges them too, that they have free will. If they don't have free will, then you can't judge them. And so the assumption is that if the brothers actually didn't want to behave that way, they wouldn't have behaved that way. And God has lots of ways of getting the Jews down to Egypt if God wants to get them down to Egypt. It doesn't have to be that the brothers sell Joseph into slavery. So on the one hand, yes. On the other hand, If God's trying to engineer a result, you can't say that every specific on the way to that result was predetermined, because that takes away the prerequisite of free will. On the third hand, yes, because at the end of the story, of course, Joseph says what you say, which is, you meant it for bad, but God meant it for good. But the interplay of God's design and free will is a big question. It's not just in the Joseph story, it's in every rabbinic story, and for that matter, all throughout history. So I'm gonna leave it there for the moment. One, two.
The word wrestle comes out of that word that we now read. Is that correct? Settle comes out of that word.
Probably.
And Jacob ends up with a tumultuous life.
Right.
So this is a repetition, really, of the renaming of Jacob, isn't it? When he became...
Say more about that.
Well, when I remember what you said, was that what name was given to Jacob? The name was Israel, which
right.
meant to wrestle. The Hebrew
yeah.
wrestled with God.
Yeah.
And that he and all of us are doomed to wrestle and create and not accept by very definition of becoming Israel. And it seems to me this is therefore either a comment on the first story, the same as the first story, or something else.
I agree with that. It's either a comment on it, the same as it, or something else. I think that's indisputable. I think that it's certainly true, as you point out, that no character in the Bible gets the kind of life that Rashi understands Jacob to be asking for. Nobody gets an easy life in the Bible. The rabbinic literature says the same thing. You know, in the Midrash on Kohelet, it says nobody dies with even half of their wishes fulfilled. Now, you may not agree with that, right? I think in our day, we already have more of our wishes fulfilled than the rabbis could ever have dreamed. But even so, you know, it's what Perez said when we were, I told that story when we came back from Israel, when the rabbis had a meeting with Perez, and he said that the greatest contribution of the Jews to the world was dissatisfaction. And there certainly is something to that. I don't think that you're supposed to be satisfied with the way the world is, and you're supposed to be troubled by it. And I like very much, I think he wasn't Jewish, but it's a very Jewish saying, what Robert Frost, in one of his poems, said that he wanted on his gravestone. He had a lover's quarrel with the world, which is a really, it's a lovely phrase, you know?
About the tables. Two tables. Are we to imagine that if you have everything that you want and luxury in this world?
Oh, are you in trouble?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. According to the rabbis, yeah, I mean, that was a very common rabbinic explanation about why people who suffer in this world suffer and why people who prosper in this world prosper. Yes. When you say, are we to understand it? If you accept that explanation, yes. If you don't, know, but a lot of the rabbis quoted that explanation. Absolutely. Yeah.
Can you read the story that you covered today? Does it promote favoritism or condemn it?
Well, does the story promote favoritism or condemn it? When you read the whole Joseph story, right, we have a long way to go. Before we read, we've only read the first two verses. But when you read the whole Joseph story, it's pretty clear to me that it condemns it. So you're not supposed to treat, you're supposed to treat your children differently, but equally. Doesn't mean that every child should be treated the same, because not every child is the same, right? You don't say to every child, you're all gonna go to this college, right? That's actually being unfair. But you have to treat each one with equal, to act equally lovingly, let me put it that way. Even if you can't love them equally, you have to act equally lovingly. But that's very hard. That's very hard. So, yeah.
Around what year does the Joseph story take place?
Well, the Exodus is supposed to be around the year, 1200 to 1300. So we're talking about 1400 BCE.
Moses comes in?
actually, it has to be even longer than that. It's, well, 290-year slavery. It doesn't actually work out to 400 years. So let's say 1600 BCE, another 300-400 years before Moses.
Going back to the shave part, the first thing that came to my mind was about sitting Shiva. And that he was, I don't know how much after Rachel's death this is, but one of the things that you said about monks and that we don't really condone that, but the one time that we do allow us to withdraw is during the time of mourning, and maybe this was a time of mourning for him and also a precursor of the mourning to come.
That's a nice idea, and actually that's a nice, the idea that during Shiva you do withdraw, but what happens, of course, is that people come and pull you back out. So even then, and you'll see Jacob overmourns for Joseph. I know that sounds strange, but you'll see when we come to it that he overmourns for it. And in fact, according to Jewish law, you're not allowed to mourn too much, right? You can't keep sitting Shiva when Shiva is over. You're not allowed to. You can't keep observing Shloshim when Shloshim is over, and you can't say Kaddish past the 11th month, even if you want to, because you're not allowed to mourn too much. So that's a nice, that's okay. Thanks for coming. No, not at all.
I guess there's a story of Rashi points out that when Leah and the family came to greet Esau, she prostrated herself in front of the kids, but Joseph is mentioned before Rachel.
Right.
That he was like protecting Rachel. So he had this wisdom or personal capacity even at a young age, I don't know, 6, 7,
mm-hmm.
which
right.
I guess is another hint that he wasn't just a heedless child.
Right. That's, yeah, it's a midrash. It's not in the Bible, but there is, I mean, you can imagine also that if you're the only child of a mother, I mean, granted, again, Benjamin was much younger, that you would feel protective when the other mother has all these kids. So I would think, yes, that Joseph probably did. And the flip side of insecurity is egomania, right? In the same way that he felt like he knew that his mother was both more vulnerable and more loved. She's more vulnerable because she only has him, but she was more loved. So he probably felt the same thing, you know, more vulnerable and more loved. And it really, you know, it certainly is true that people, that it is possible to see those as parts of the same personality, so.
You mentioned before briefly about Israel and Jacob.
Yes.
It has been used interchangeably in here.
Yeah.
Please mention something about it and also the significance of 17 years of
Jacob. Well, I don't know what the significance is of 17 years other than it situates you understand what age we're talking about with Joseph. It just gives you a mental picture of where he is in the story. We talked a lot about Israel and Jacob when we did the story, but it's used interchangeably. There are people who've tried to trace exactly when it's used, but it seems to me that it's used without a consistent basis throughout all the rest of not only Bereishit, but even in the rest of the Bible and even in the prayers where you say, you know, Elohe Abraham, Elohe Yitzchak, Elohe Yaakov. You don't say Elohe Israel. So it depends. Usually when you're talking about Jacob as the progenitor of a people, you say Israel. When you're talking about the person Jacob, you say Jacob. But it doesn't follow perfectly from that. if there are another... Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
The next part of the story where Joseph is going to the field and runs across Jacob,
well, we will get to. Yeah, we will get to. Right, exactly. Yeah.
The season, that story always reminds me of the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
Where the Jimmy Stewart character runs across
Clarence.
Yeah.
Yep. Except that Clarence turns out to be more helpful than the guy does, you know. Yeah, that's true. But he was talking about It's a Wonderful Life. We'll come to that more, but that actually supports what you said earlier, which is that this is all determined. When you were asking the question about whether it's determined or not, the idea that he meets someone who happens to know where his brothers are and points him to it suggests that, you know, that there's this hidden hand in this. I do want to read you this from, and those of you who were here this past Shabbos in Shul, and if you weren't, why not? know that this comment was a little bit the subject of the sermon. I talked about why it is that God never speaks to Joseph. But this is what Sarna says. There are no direct divine revelations or communications to Joseph, right? There are to the other patriarchs, but God never speaks to Joseph. He builds no altars. He has no association with cultic centers. God never openly or directly intervenes in his life. That's a very interesting difference, right, with everything that we have seen so far. In some ways, although God makes a major reappearance, obviously, in the Exodus, but in some ways, Joseph is a model for us in a way that the other patriarchs aren't. Because even though Joseph interprets dreams and says, God allowed me to interpret the dreams, we never see God talking to Joseph. We never see Joseph directly talking to God. What we see is Joseph invoking God all the time and talking about God all the time. But that's very different from Jacob. And one of the ironies of their lives, and I remember several weeks ago, I read the Midrash about how many parallels there are between Jacob and Joseph. There are a lot of them. But one of the contrasts of their lives is that God intervenes in Jacob's life a lot, and Jacob is miserable and unhappy. Right? At the end of his life, he says to Pharaoh, few and bitter have been the years of my life. God doesn't intervene in Joseph's life, and Joseph is happy and prosperous. And I don't know if the Torah is deliberately intending us to understand something from that, but I think it's very interesting that that's how it's set up. Now, next time we're going to talk about Joseph's. We'll probably get to the dreams, and we'll talk specifically about why his brothers hate him, and if we in fact know why his brothers hate him, because one, and this is characteristic of the Bible, the Bible works in what's called parataxis, which means that it uses and. This happened, and this happened. But it doesn't say, because of this, that happened. And we have to figure out what the cause and effect is, because it doesn't tell us what the cause and effect is. So it tells us about the dreams, it tells us about the coat, and it tells us that Joseph is hated. But it doesn't say Joseph is hated because of the dream and the coat. So why Joseph is hated exactly is something that we'll have to discuss last time. Any final questions? This is one of the rare, this may be the only time this year when I can say we have class next week. So if all's well and we're well, we all have class next week. So let's just stand up for 1 second for Kaddish to Rabbanan, which is the time that you say after studying Torah, and then we'll go. Yikadal v'yikadash.